This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is Senior Editor Chris Sheridan.
Chris Viflava, Chief Investment Officer of Financial Sense Wealth Management, joins us on the show today. And last time we spoke with Chris was actually to discuss his quarterly newsletter from earlier this year, Records Were Made to Be Broken. And in that interview, Chris provided the outlook that the bull market run and U.S. economic expansion would likely continue, perhaps even to become the longest ever in length. And that was based on looking at a number of different key milestones or landmarks that we can identify that are associated with bear markets and also recessions. None of those were showing any signs. So that was the last conversation we had. In this conversation, we're going to discuss the game plan for late cycle investing, which was the latest piece that Chris Viflava wrote. We'll also have a link out to that where this interview is located on Financial Sense if you want to look through some of the charts and data. But with that said, Chris, thank you for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
So the first thing that you discuss are really three key themes, and these are being widely talked about in the financial media today. Let's go through each of them one by one and get your outlook on them, and with the first being a rise in volatility for this year.
If you look at where volatility has been over the last few years, we've seen record low levels. So saying that it's likely to be higher is a pretty easy prediction to make, not really much lower than we can go. But what I wanted to highlight was why I think volatility is going to go up, not just simply because it's at very low levels. And mainly it's that proverbial quote, a rising tide lifts all boats. And if you play that backwards, a sinking tide sinks all ships. And in terms of liquidity and the rising tide, what I'm looking at is the amount of money being sloshed around the global financial system. For the last 8 to 9 years or so, we've had a tremendous amount of money pumped into the global financial system from central banks printing trillions of dollars. And we are now seeing that tide begin to recede. When you look at the top 7 central banks of the world and you look at their collective balance sheets and what the growth rate in those balance sheets are, by 2019, we are going to see global QE, not just the Fed and the European central banks, but global QE turn negative on an annual rate of change basis for the first time since a brief stint we had in 2015. And if you can remember what happened in 2015 when global central bank balance sheet growth was slowing, we had China, which devalued its currency several times. We had double-digit corrections. And many, if not most, market technicians were calling the end of the bull market. And they said the bull market was over. We had begun a new bear market. And that was just with central bank liquidity turning slightly negative. And we're looking at least the projections from Bank of America. If they're correct in their projections, we are going to see negative liquidity globally in QE balance sheets by the spring of 2019, even larger than what we saw in 2015. So the stakes are definitely raised, in my opinion, over the next year. As central banks, you know, essentially they were behind the markets. They were a tailwind, and now they're becoming the headwind. And one of the benefits of money is it does paper over a multitude of sins. If you look at all the money being printed, in my opinion, that's really a big driver of why volatility has dampened. But as we see liquidity begin to recede, I think volatility is going to pick up a lot more as there's less money sloshing around the system, bidding assets higher.
And as we've been discussing on our show for many years, I mean, looking at liquidity measures are huge if you're going to be on the right side of the market. Let's move to the second theme. The second one is rising inflation. This is something that is, again, being discussed quite often. Nowadays, we see a number of different measures, whether or not we're talking about wage inflation. You have a number of key charts that you look at here with manufacturing related to core CPI. So let's talk about that second theme.
Sure. One of the things we were getting concerned about late last year was a potential rise in inflation. And there's a lot of indicators that do a really good job of giving you good lead time in terms of where inflation rates are likely to be headed. And it was because of the concern that we had that we would be seeing inflation rising this year, that usually if you look at inflation rates and interest rates, they tend to move in the same direction. And so one of the things that we felt as a firm was that interest rates would be moving up this year. And that's why when we were looking at our bond portfolios for clients, we were dramatically reducing the long-term fixed rate bonds that we have, and we started to move into floating rate bonds, which benefit with rising inflation and interest rates. But part of the reason that we were concerned about a pickup in inflation this year was if you look at past activity in terms of manufacturing, as manufacturing activity picks up, there's more usage of commodities, there's more turnover in terms of the economy and growth, that tends to lead inflation. And one of the things that does a good job of predicting that is the ISM manufacturing PMI. And we saw global growth really pick up. You know, if you look at 2015, as we were mentioned, global liquidity was shrinking. We really felt that in the manufacturing sector. For all intents and purposes, I would say we almost had a manufacturing recession in 2014 to 2016. But oil prices recovered, global growth began to pick up, and for the last 2 years, manufacturing activity has gone straight up. And that tends to lead CPI data by about, I'd say, 18 months to 2 years. And so it's no surprise that we're seeing a pickup in inflation. And I don't think this is just going to be a one-off event, a few months or a quarter. I think we're going to see a general rise in inflation all the way out through this year and even into 2019. If you look at since the recovery began in 2009, we've really already had about two different kind of periods of rising inflation. Certainly after the recession ended in 2010, we saw a pickup in inflation, and then it peaked in 2012, and it started to cool off into 2014-15. Then we saw another kind of wave of inflation increasing from 2014 to about 2016. And then again, as oil prices collapsed, general economic activity rolled over, inflation moved back down. But it stabilized late last year, and it's starting to turn up, and I think we're going to see that we're going to be witnessing the third pickup in inflationary growth since the recovery began back in 2009. It's not just a pickup in manufacturing that I think is going to lead to higher prices. At least here in the U.S., one of the big things is that we're worried about in terms of what small businesses are concerned about is the lack of available labor. We've got the unemployment rate at 4.1 right now, and if we go down to about 3.8, that would be the lowest unemployment rate in a half century. So the problem with a low unemployment rate, at least from a business perspective, is there's less available quality people to fill the jobs that you have available. And the National Federation of Independent Business, they're the small business lobby group. What they do is they survey small businesses every month, and they ask them, what are your top concerns? And the number one right now, or at least 22% of those surveyed, said that poor labor quality is their top concern. Now, at the height of the last cycle back in 2007, I think roughly around 15-16% of small businesses cited that as their top concern. We're at 22% right now, and that is the highest concern rate we've seen since 2000. And that makes sense if you look at where the unemployment rate is. So the problem is if you're a business and you've got job openings because you've got demand and you can't find available labor to fill that job, well, what are you left with doing? You're actually concerned that your employees might quit and go to another firm for a higher wages. And so what you're seeing is to keep your current talent, you're having to give them more benefits, higher wages, and salary, and that's leading to higher wage inflation. And wage inflation should play a significant role in overall inflationary levels for the U.S. economy. And not only are we going to likely continue to see wage inflation pick up, which feeds into general levels of inflation, the other thing we need to worry about is the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar does play a significant role in terms of commodity prices and import inflation. And so a weak dollar, when that falls relative to a basket of currencies, their goods become more expensive to U.S. citizens. And so the price of imports goes up when the dollar falls, and vice versa. When the dollar rises, the price of imports go down. So if you look at the weakness we've seen in the U.S. dollar over the last year, that's likely to lead to higher import inflation, which will then contribute to higher overall levels of inflation. So the concerns I have for and reasons why I believe the inflation will be rising throughout this year is the previous pickup in manufacturing, the continued pressure we're going to see in wage inflation, and the weak dollar that we've seen in the past year. All of these three forces, I believe, will be significant contributors to why we're going to see higher inflation this year. Higher inflation, in my opinion, also means probably higher interest rates. They tend to move hand in hand with each other.
And related to that, I guess we should point out that there's a number of clear investment implications and strategies that people want to be taking into consideration if these trends do play out as you expect. Again, we're looking at the first theme, which is rising volatility. We saw that in spades starting February. And as you noted earlier, that was a pretty safe bet. I mean, we saw record low volatility all of 2017. So a mean reversion in that case was certainly something that we could expect. We did see that. And then rising inflation, as you just noted, you know, we see a pickup in manufacturing activity, wage inflation with small businesses not being able to find qualified workers, and the weaker dollar. And you can look at all these charts and see the leading relationships that they have, just if you want to see the visuals for yourself. Let's move to the third theme that you discuss, which is rising sentiment levels. This is a very important part of the subject as well when we think about where the markets are headed and some of the longer term cycles at play. So where are you seeing investor sentiment, business sentiment currently, and how does that relate to your outlook for this year?
Sure, that's a good question. You know, one of the things that you tend to see at the very end of a bull market is that's when everyone is the most euphoric. And it's not just the stock market. If you think back to the housing market in 2005 and how everyone was getting rich on housing and you had all these people buying multiple investment properties that they were renting out, that was no different than how everyone was buying stocks in the late 90s, using margin, speculating. And we even saw that recently with, in my opinion, the bubble we saw in Bitcoin, which you and I discussed just before the peak late last year. And going back to what you see in terms of tops, you see bullish sentiment. That was one of the missing ingredients, in my opinion, back in 2015 when a lot of market technicians were calling for a bear market. If you remember the 2007 top and you look at the financial press, both, you know, the newspaper agencies plus CNBC, Fox Business, and Bloomberg, you weren't hearing anyone calling for a market top. They're saying this was a pullback, this is a correction, this is a buying opportunity. Even in early 2008, when we were already months into a recession, people are still arguing that we weren't in a recession. It was just a temporary downturn in the economy. So, you know, at the top, you don't see sentiment bearish. It's usually the complete opposite. And that was one of the things that I noticed in 2015 and early 16 when the market was very volatile and China was devaluing its currency, was that everyone was calling for a recession or a bear market in the stock market. So it didn't smell of a top, at least in terms of what we historically see. But fast forward to today, and I think we're seeing sentiment levels rise everywhere. If you remember back in November 2016 when Donald Trump was elected president, the very next month, the National Federation of Independent Business, their optimism index saw the single largest monthly increase ever in the history of the data, even going back to Ronald Reagan in the 80s. So, you know, with the Trump election, we saw small business finally begin to be more optimistic that he was going to be pro-business. You saw consumer sentiment continue to move north. Investor sentiment became very bullish as the stock market rallied. So surveying multiple areas for investor, business, and consumer sentiment, everything was moving up. And this, to me, was the missing ingredient that we now have for a potential market top. Sentiment is clearly bullish. And I want to give, or at least I gave a few examples of what sentiment looks like at market tops. And one of the things I included in my article was the State of the Union by Calvin Coolidge back in December 4th, 1928. He gave that speech literally just about a year before the October 1929 market crash. And when you read his, you know, message, at least the paragraph that I highlighted, you would thought, you know, every world problem was solved, world hunger and everything. The first sentence was, "No Congress of the United States ever assembled on surveying the State of the Union has met with a more pleasing prospect." And that literally was said just before the onset of the stock market crash of 1929, the Great Depression. So that was a sentiment leading into that top. And another thing that I highlighted was a commercial that was out just before the tech bubble of 2000. It was Discover Brokerage. Now, everyone knows of Discover Credit Card, but they actually launched a brokerage unit, kind of cashing in on that move in technology stocks and everyone investing. And it was a picture of a tow truck driver who was retired, and he retired by investing in the stock market, and he actually owned his own island. It's a very funny commercial, but it really does speak to, in my opinion, the sentiment at the time And more recently, one of the Fed governors, Neil Kashkari, he was in LAX, and he was speaking to someone, a customs agent there, who asked what he did, and he, you know, told him he was a Fed governor. And he then asked him what he thought about cryptocurrencies, and his friend took out a $35,000 HELOC to invest in cryptocurrencies. That literally was about 2 to 3 weeks before the top. You know, this is the type of sentiment you see, and I gave, you know, three examples, the 1929 crash, the tech bubble, and recently Bitcoin, but this is what you see, you know, near market tops. And so one of the charts I include was where we are in terms of small business sentiment. We are seeing one of the highest levels ever. When you look at consumer confidence, we are seeing also one of the highest levels ever, almost back to where we were in the year 2000. We are well above where we were in 2007, not only on the small business sentiment, but also consumer sentiment. So, you know, one of the missing hallmarks of a market top was sentiment. You can check that box because we clearly have that now. And that, to me, also indicates that we are closer to the end than the beginning, while we really need to start focusing on risk management as we are at the late cycle of this business and stock market cycle.
We'll be back for more with Chris Poplava in just a minute.
Everyone loves the stock market when it's going up. Making money in the markets, when you think about it, seems easy, which it is when you're in the middle of a bull market. But stocks, as you well know, don't always go up. And there are times when they can go down, in fact, go down a lot, which is why you need to have an investment strategy to help you navigate the good times along with the bad. Not everyone has an investment strategy, and quite honestly, many of you don't. That is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. We can put together an investment strategy to help you navigate those volatile investment markets in good times and bull markets and the bear markets that follow.
Call Financial Sense Advisors now and let us help you to make the change from just retiring to thriving in retirement. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. Again, that's 888-486-3939. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
It is a huge, massively distributed network, censorship resistant with, you know, these Blockstream satellites. And Blockstream recently entered into a deal with ICE where you're going to have a Bitcoin price feed in dollars. And so if we were actually able to broadcast that price feed along with the blockchain via these satellites, we can use that, that can then go into smart contracts. So, I mean, if the world is rethinking what money is, and it's either dollars or gold or something else, and if it's Bitcoin, how do we manage this transition from the old system to the new system? And, you know, when you start handling that with something that's immutable and censorship resistant and decentralized like Bitcoin is, then you don't get to do a hard fork, you know, and be like, oh, well, the dollar used to be a certain amount of gold and now it's not, or it's a certain amount less of gold. Nope, you don't get to do hard forks like that, not with Bitcoin.
Okay, Chris, so as you just mentioned, if we look at sentiment indicators, whether or not we're looking at business sentiment, consumer sentiment, there's a number of different things that we can look at. And again, that is a crucial ingredient for the formation of a market top. But as we know, market tops are a process. They're not an event. So with that in mind, what are your thoughts in terms of a timeline? I mean, really quickly, are you thinking that that's 2018 story, a 2019 story? What are your thoughts on that?
Sure. You know, I think this is a good question. Kind of goes back to what I wrote about and discussed in January. I do think records in terms of the length of this bull market and stock market are going to be broken. I'm not seeing enough signs that we're beginning that topping process. So, you know, tops are a process and they can last a long time. And when I look at the data in terms of the stock market and the economy, I think we're going further and likely see higher stock prices this year. I think we're going to skirt a recession in 2018. 2019 is still on the table. But at least for 2018, you know, tops are a process, which means you, if you see us losing momentum, you can kind of start to be concerned about a top. given I don't see any lost momentum, I still think we've got many months ahead of us of continued growth in the economy and continued upward mobility in the stock market. So what I was highlighting in terms of sentiment was just that that missing ingredient is now there. That means you need to be on alert for a top. Not that there's an imminent top around the corner, but now is the time to really start browsing the data and keeping an eye on when we might be losing that momentum and starting the topping process. So it clearly means you need to be a lot more vigilant, and you really need to be looking at everything that comes across the data wires.
And I guess I should probably just point out for any of those listening that might be skeptical, thinking, well, you can't really identify that beforehand. It's going to take you by surprise, no matter who you are, an economist or strategist or whatever. And most people think that because 2008, for example, took many people by surprise. You know, it's named to be a historical anomaly in terms of the speed and the magnitude of the drawdown that we saw. But, you know, you've been at this for a little while, Chris. I mean, you've been tracking the economy. You've been investing for clients for quite some time. And so I think probably should give you some kudos, because in 2007 into 2008, you were one of the few people out there really warning investors, hey, watch out below, proceed with caution. The LEIs are turning down, and just understanding the overall, I would say, backdrop of what we were facing with a potential credit crisis. You were making those warnings and you were allocating capital accordingly. So for those that might be skeptical thinking you can't do that beforehand, we could certainly point back to a number of articles that you wrote during that time. So with that said, let's move on to how this relates to investment implications. And again, the title of this piece that you just wrote is The Game Plan for Late Cycle Investing. As you just mentioned, you don't think that a top is imminent, but given some of these themes that we discussed, you have to be on alert for that. And so there is a process that is unfolding that you see. And with that process, you are also making certain decisions and changes to portfolios. So let's talk about the game plan as you see it, given these three themes and putting them into practice.
I think the number one idea is begin to take chips off the table. You don't want to get too greedy and overstay your welcome. And when you've got a lot of profits from being in a bull market and the growth that comes with the bull market, it does make sense to begin to de-risk, not swing for the fences, and start booking some profits. One of the things I highlighted was a famous quote by Warren Buffett, who said, rule number one, never lose money. Rule number two, never forget rule number one. The reason for that is just the power of compounding. Compounding can work for or against you. And in terms of how it can work against you, one of the things that I review every single quarter is J.P. Morgan's Guide to the Markets, which I highly recommend listeners look at every quarter. But one of the charts I used from the report was the gain required to fully recover from a loss. For example, if you fall, let's say, 10%, you need to rally 11% to break even. If you fall 20%, which is a textbook definition of a bear market, you have to rally 25% to break even. And they go further on. If you had a 70% decline, you need to rally 233% just to break even. J.P. Morgan, they also kind of looked at some of the historical bear markets that we've seen over the last 100 years. And when looking at those bear markets, the average bear market decline of those was 45%. Now, if you fall 45%, you have to rally 82% just to break even. So that is why you really want to avoid losses, according to Warren Buffett, is because the further you fall, the further you have to go to break even. A good example of this is, let's say you had $1 million portfolio and you fell 50%. Now you have $500,000 portfolio. You have to double your money to break even. But let's say you were very conservative. Instead of falling 50%, maybe only fell 10%. So you have $900,000. And in the next bull market doubles. But what if you didn't, because you're conservative? Maybe you're only at 50% or so. Well, you're going to have close to $1.5 million portfolio, while the other portfolio, which is always in, which fell 50%, it has to double just to break even. So that's how you don't have to beat the market to beat the market in the long run. You can simply just lose less. And that was a really key point that J.P. Morgan illustrated. Another chart which I took from them was they looked at various portfolios. So looking at 100% stock-only portfolio, they used the S&P 500 as that example. They looked at a 40-60 stock bond portfolio and a 60-40 stock bond portfolio. And what they were looking at was, using the October 2007 peak, how long did it take for those various portfolios to break even? So in terms of the 40-60 stock bond portfolio, that had the most amount of bonds, which was the most conservative during that bear market and initial part of the bull market, by November of 2009, so just over 2 years, the 40-60 portfolio completely recovered its losses. The 60-40 stock bond portfolio took to October of 2010 to break even. So that took, you know, almost a full another year just by simply having a 20% increase in stocks versus the 40-60 portfolio. It took the S&P 500 all the way until March of 2012, nearly 5 years to break even, because it fell so much more dramatically than a balanced portfolio. And, you know, what I just gave you, those are the break-even levels. What's interesting is, if you look at the S&P, it actually, and that's a 100% stock-only portfolio, it did not beat a 40-60 or 60-40 stock bond portfolio until after 2014, when it finally played catch-up. And so it literally took the S&P 500 7 years to play catch-up with the value from a 60-40 or 40-60 stock bond portfolio. And the simple reason is this. If you're up 100% and you're up 100% on $1 million, well, you just made $1 million. If you're 100% on $500,000, you made $500,000. And so the idea is that if you preserve your capital, you're growing and compounding your returns on a larger base. And that's why risk management is so important near the end of a business cycle, when you're going to be staring at a recession or bear market in the stocks, to really begin to minimize your losses. And that's what this image by J.P. Morgan really, in my opinion, captures, is how risk management is so important at the end of a business cycle.
Okay, so you include really two strategies, I should say, in this portion of game plan for late cycle investing. And the strategy number two that you outline is really where we get to the nuts and bolts of this. Let's talk about shifting towards late cycle investments, and what are the sectors or asset classes that perform best in the latter parts of the business cycle?
Historically, what tends to do the best at the very end of a cycle or late cycle is commodities, because that's when inflation is at its highest point. If you look at the early part of the business cycle and the middle part of the business cycle, stocks handedly beat most every other asset class. Commodities, high yield junk bonds, investment grade corporate bonds, stocks have the best return profile. But when you get in late cycle, stocks are not the best investment, at least in terms of historical returns. They lose that to commodities, which are the number one. And even though stocks still produce a good return, their edge over bonds begins to shrink as well. So if you look at the amount of volatility you get in a stock portfolio versus the amount of volatility in a bond portfolio, there's less of a, you know, risk-reward picture there. And one of the things that is important to do is to really hedge your portfolio near the end of a business cycle when inflation begins to pick up. And there's numerous ways to do this, and pulling from data from Fidelity, which goes back to 1966, and what they were looking at was annualized real returns during periods of rising inflation. And what some of the best investments or hedges against inflation are commodity resource stocks, like material stocks, energy stocks. Gold tends to do very well. Other commodities tends to do very well. These all beat the general level of return in the stock market, and they clearly beat cash returns such as T-bills and even treasury rates. And so as you get near the end of a business cycle, not only do you want to start to dial down risk, but you also want to worry about current concerns at the time, which is typically at the end of a cycle you're worried about inflation. And what I highlighted in my piece was how you want to shift towards protecting your portfolio from inflation with equities. But it's also important to know that even with bonds, there's an investment cycle with bonds. In the first part of the business cycle, when you just went through a bear market and default risk begins to recede, the returns on risky areas of the bond market, such as junk bonds and investment-grade bonds, tends to outperform treasuries. And as you get near the end of the business cycle, when interest rates are beginning to move, you tend to see risky areas of the bond market do better than treasuries, such as junk bonds, investment-grade bonds as well. But other things that tend to do well are floating-rate bonds. You know, floating-rate bonds provide good return in rising interest rate environments. Those are not something you want to own during a recession when interest rates are falling. But even on your bond portfolio, you kind of really want to pay attention where you are in the business cycle. And if inflation is to pick up as well as interest rates, a defensive way to invest in the bond market would be to move towards short-term bonds that you can reset in the ladder at higher interest rates as they mature, as well as floating rate bonds. So that's something to really think about, is how you protect various asset classes in the very latter part of a business cycle, not just with equities, but also even the choices you make on your bond investments. It behooves you to switch towards shorter-term bonds as well as floating-rate bonds as a protection against rising interest rates.
And I should note that we're also going to be having our bond market strategist, Rob Bernard, on as our lifetime income guest on Tuesday to elaborate a little bit further on that strategy as it relates to a rising interest rate environment when we think about how you can use a floating rate bond market strategy versus TIPS and some of the pros and cons of each of those. So that'll be something, if any of you want to learn more about, certainly listen to that interview on Tuesday. Chris, let's talk about the last section that you get into. I'm thinking this might make a number of people out there pretty happy if they're gold bugs or gold enthusiasts, and that's where you ask the question of whether or not it is time for gold. So this is something that, you know, we haven't been extremely bullish on gold for quite some time. For many of our longtime listeners, they will know that we had been really discussing gold since early 2000s, and Jim Poplava was certainly an early investor in that area. So with that background, bring us up to today in terms of what your thoughts are on gold from the perspective of Financial Sense Wealth Management and some of the things that you're looking at as far as whether or not this is a viable investment strategy or asset that investors should be owning.
One of the things I look at in terms of gold is gold's not simple to analyze. Sometimes it acts as an anti-dollar play. Sometimes it acts as an inflation hedge. Sometimes it's a geopolitical hedge. So there's many, many variables that go into the price movement for gold. And obviously, it's a commodity, so there's supply and demand issues there as well. But there's two that I really pay attention to. One of them is the level of real interest rates. Real interest rates are the simple level of interest rates minus the rate of inflation. So let's say a 10-year treasury is producing a yield of 3%. And the inflation rate's 2%, well, real-term interest rates are 1%. You just back out inflation. And gold tends to do well when real interest rates fall. And what that means is that the rate of inflation is rising faster than interest rates. And if you go back to the 70s when the Fed was basically chasing its tail, inflation rates were well above current market interest rates, such that real interest rates were negative. When real interest rates are negative, that's when gold tends to do its best. And one of the things that concerned me going into the first part of this year was that I had not seen a pickup in inflation at a rate that was equal to the rate that we were seeing increasing in interest rates. And so if interest rates moved up precipitously while inflation did not, that would mean real interest rates would rise, not fall, and that would be negative for gold. But that's something I am keeping an eye on, is if inflation does really begin to pick up, while interest rates begin to stabilize and maybe they stop going up, we'll see real interest rates fall, and that would be bullish for gold. So that's something I'm clearly watching this year to see if real interest rates do fall, which would benefit gold. Secondly, another thing I look for is gold as an anti-dollar play. Typically, when gold is functioning well as an anti-dollar play, other currencies are doing well relative to the dollar. And one of the ones I look at most is the U.S. yen exchange rate. And what I found historically, the yen-dollar exchange rate tends to lead the price in gold. One of the things that turned me very bearish on gold back in 2012 was the Bank of Japan came out and they really ramped up money printing and devalued their currency. And that first phase from the fall of 2012 to the fall of 2013, interestingly, the Japanese yen relative to the dollar fell about 25%, as did gold. They both fell very similarly in terms of magnitude and direction. But the yen fell first. Gold peaked later. And the yen does tend to provide kind of a leading edge on price movements in gold. Back in 2015, We saw the Japanese yen bottom in the summer, and then later in December of 2015, gold eventually bottomed. And one of the things that was a good lead on where gold was heading in 2016 was noticing what the yen did. Both the gold and yen had a really good rally in the first part of 2016, but the yen collapsed in the latter part of 2016 and just went straight back down, almost back to where it was in 2015. But it broke down several weeks to a month before the price of gold broke down. So that was a clear window of warning to gold investors to pay attention. And had they done so, they would have mitigated some of the losses that were seen late in 2016. What is causing me to keep my eye on gold this year is if you look at the Japanese yen from 2012, it is starting to break out of a bearish trend that it's been in for years, and that could be warning that we're getting ready to see a breakout in gold. Now, for me, the proof is in the pudding. And so for me, I would need to see gold break above $1,400 an ounce to really kind of believe that there's some strength behind the movement in gold. While we are already seeing the yen break out, we have not yet seen gold. So for me, confirmation that this could be a good year for gold, I would want to see it north of $1,400 an ounce. And we're still below that, so that's why I'm only watching it and not making any shifts in allocation for clients.
And since some of these relationships are a bit complex, whether or not we're talking about real interest rates or if we're talking about the Japanese yen and how they relate to gold, I do want to encourage all of our listeners to click the link that we have located where this interview is on Financial Sense so that you can access the charts. Sometimes you just need to have a visual since, of course, you know, an image speaks a thousand words. So, Chris, with that said, why don't you give us a summary of what we've discussed so far in terms of the themes and the investment implications as it relates to your game plan for late cycle investing?
The number one thing I think you really need to be on alert for is a pickup in volatility. I think as investors, we were a little bit spoiled over the last 2 years where it was almost a one-way trip with stocks. They went straight up, not a lot of volatility on the downside. And we've already started to see that this year. And I think what we saw beginning January to February is just a prelude to what is to come. We should see more pullbacks in the market, you know, 3%, 5% pullbacks. I think that would be a return to normal. So I would expect to see more swings in the market. And the other thing I think we're going to see is a pickup in inflation. I highlight a couple of reasons for that, pickup in manufacturing, weakness in the dollar, and continued pressure from wage inflation. I think all these things will be contributing to higher inflation rates, which also, in my opinion, will lead to higher interest rates. So I think you need to be on alert for kind of protecting your portfolio from a general rise of inflation, which goes a little bit further. You typically see that in the latter part of the business cycle, just before the end, which is leading into recession. And one of the things that you typically see near the end, and kind of another check in the checkbox list approaching that eventual top, is a real shift in bullish sentiment, whether that be in businesses, in consumers, or investors. We are clearly seeing a huge increase in sentiment to levels typically associated near market tops. That being said, I don't feel that we're going to be witnessing a top in the economy or the stock market anytime soon. I don't believe that's imminent, but it's clearly time to be on alert for that and to really be watching. And if we are in the later part of the business cycle, as I believe, this is a time that you really want to focus on late cycle strategies like reducing risk, taking some chips off the table, and also you want to prepare for higher inflation. And one of the best hedges against that is commodity and commodity-related investments in terms of equities and in terms of the bond market. You want to move out of the long-term bonds, which would get hit with rising interest rates. You want to move into short-term bonds and floating-rate bonds. Those are two areas that are defensive strategies in a rising interest rate environment.
Chris, for any of our listeners that want to know more about Financial Sense Wealth Management's services and some of the things that we can assist our listeners with when it comes to taking a lot of what we discussed today and putting it into practice, would you mind just giving a brief overview of some of the things that we offer?
Sure. We offer investment management services, financial planning, whole suite of services to help clients to manage their finances and to grow their wealth. We also provide a comprehensive risk assessment. We have a lot of tools at our disposal to look at one's portfolios, whether it be a bond portfolio or equity portfolio, to generally to get a good sense of the amount of risk that's being taken in there And I think that's very important to do as we are nearing the end of this business cycle, is to really understand how much risk you're taking. And clients and prospective clients can reach out to us to do a free risk assessment of their portfolios.
We've been speaking with Chris Poplava, Chief Investment Officer of Financial Sense Wealth Management. And Chris, lastly, if any of our listeners want to get in contact with you to learn more about Financial Sense Wealth Management or to discuss any of the things that were brought up in today's show, what would be the best way to do so?
They can give me a call toll-free at 888-486-3939, or they can email me at chris.poplava@financialsense.com.
Jim, that was an interesting conversation between Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava. Obviously, we're planning for the shows for the weeks to come. So what are we looking forward to? Coming attractions. Give me a trailer here.
Coming attractions. The big event this month will be the FOMC meeting coming up here in the next week or two. And of course, that will be Chairman Powell's first meeting. And it's also a key meeting because the Fed revises its forecast for the year. We're going to want to look at the dot plot. Are they still holding to that, which would indicate they're still on track to raise it three times? Or are they raising that dot plot, indicating they may be getting more aggressive? So that's a big event coming up in the next couple of weeks. And of course, the first quarter is about to close. So anybody that's going to miss estimates, probably not too many because most companies are beating expectations, but we're going to get right into the first quarter earnings season coming up here in the next month. So all of that coming forward, and we'll be here to talk about it, as we hope you will as well. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.